Good afternoon. This is Michael Osterlink, and I'm pleased to bring back my friend Robert Dubois. He is the author of the new book, Powerful Peace, A Navy SEAL's Lessons on Peace from a Lifetime at War. Good afternoon, Rob.
Good afternoon, Michael. This is great to be back again. Thank you for inviting me.
You're quite welcome. A lot to talk about. I'm very excited to see how well received your book and your ideas have become. And it's interesting to note that it's not just within the quote-unquote war-fighting community or the diplomatic community, but your message is spread to so many diverse communities. I would like to spend a little bit of time at least talking about how your message has been received in these diverse communities and where it's heading.
I'd love to talk about that too, of course, because we've done a lot of discussion about the concepts in the book over the past few weeks. Well, we haven't delved into deeply is the applicability of it. That's being proven right now. The first indicator I had was about a year ago with one of the advanced copies, and there's a lady, I think I talked about her on a previous interview, a hijabi friend, a Muslim lady who wears the hijab in Ottawa, Canada, who began applying the simple principle of CAPAS, C-A-P or CAP, which I jokingly call busting a cap, you know, for conflict prevention as compared to actual violence. She was using the principles in her special education classroom in Ottawa, Canada, and said, it's incredible that by just, you know, putting the kids' minds on, and this is special education students, not a standard classroom. And so that one little tiny morsel from the book was already being used a year ago to make one classroom in Canada a better place to be and help the kids have a stronger environment in which to actually learn and not be tied up in interpersonal conflict. That is the tip of the spear, tip of the iceberg.
Well, it's definitely a great example. You know, just using that particular example from your book, the pause, can be so helpful for any human being in any relationship, not just in the educational sphere, but it's great to hear how effective it's been for these students in the school in Canada. What other examples do you have of this book inspiring folks and implementing some of the ideas?
Well, the most immediate example is what I just literally a few minutes ago posted at the blog. Of course, the blog can be clicked through from the main book site at powerfulpeace.net. That's www.powerfulpeace.net. And click on the blog link to go to the blog, which is hosted at WordPress. I just posted a follow-up note to my posting an article yesterday about how the book is being used in a classroom in Kentucky with a friend, Jane Poland. She, several months ago, told me she was inspired to take the concepts she had read in the advanced preview of the book that I sent her and was crafting a curriculum for 2013 for her high school English class, looking at not only the English of the book, because they have to look at books because it's literature, but the content. What is the book about? What are the lessons that come away from it? If a bunch of Canadian kids can pick up a cause-a-pause concept at an elementary school level, then how far can we take this thing with high school students? So she began, without even talking to me about it at first, began notionalizing this curriculum for a course for the year, and she touched base with me, and we made some plans, and in fact, we're in the final stage now of sending off 50 signed copies to her school to be used in this high school class to teach the kids the English part of it, of course, but more importantly, the concepts that are involved in Powerful Peace, because she and many other followers, many of the people listening right now, are supporters of Powerful Peace and are very vocal about it at Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn, and they have said again and again, we must get these ideas into the minds of kids. The youth are the people that will grow up tomorrow and be our generals and our presidents and our lawyers and our business people. And if they have this broader mind, I keep talking about wide-minding, or widening minds, not changing them. I don't care if a Democrat becomes a Republican or vice versa. I don't care if people flip their stance on the issues. It's not about trying to convince people against their will. It's about opening the aperture and letting people think more broadly and put more information into their decision factor, which ultimately helps them to make more focused decisions and understand the bigger picture, which tears away at conflict itself. So Jane is, she wrote back and said, you know, I appreciate the posting, but it really wasn't, you know, you're praising my contribution too much. And I said, au contraire. And I did a second article about it today, which folks can go look at right now. It was Aesop, A Summer of Powerful Peace, entry number 50. Over the past 2.5 months, we've been doing this A Summer of Powerful Peace Aesop program with the release. I strongly recommend folks take a look at that and see what I was trying to say about teachers and about the incredibly important impact that teachers have on our society today, for which they are not adequately rewarded, and far more importantly for tomorrow's society when the fruits of their efforts will be proven.
Well, it sounds to me that you're in the very early stages of creating a community of powerful peace practitioners, especially in the education field. Now, I'm sure our listeners would know teachers. Our teachers are connected to various teaching institutions. What would you suggest for them if they're interested in both seeing how other people are implementing it and if they have their own ideas how to implement it? How do they connect with you? How do they connect with other people who are trying to implement these ideas? Are we at the point now that we can have this kind of conversation, or are we kind of too early in this practice?
I would say there's no such thing as too early in this case. There's no urgency. It's not an emergency at this point. It is a very good time to start talking about this, and I'm easily accessible. I'm Robert at PowerfulPeace.net. It's as simple as that. We make it, my team who built the websites for PowerfulPeace.net and the Peace Hawks and PeaceHawks.org, folks can link to the supporting sites like Peace Hawks, which is a completely different discussion about an organization, what you said, like-minded individuals supporting Powerful Peace and the concepts therein. We're not talking about a bunch of salespeople running around trying to sell a book, but we're talking about people from the left and the right and the top and the bottom of the economic structure and all across society who are saying, these concepts affect me. These are making my life better. I'll tell you what, an amazing thing I saw last week that moved me deeply had nothing to do with international conflict or war, had nothing to do with the larger scale thing we tend to think are larger scale issues. It was about a couple, longtime supporters of Powerful Peace, friends of mine via Twitter and other social media, and they wrote to me at our Powerful Peace group at Facebook. The wife wrote to me and said, "Rob, wanted you to know that you know, we've applied the principles of Powerful Peace and we went from a very bad place." This is how she phrased the first comment. We were in a very bad place, and through sharing the ideas in Powerful Peace, we came to a very good place together. And I thought she was talking about some kind of a situation in which they had lost a family member or some other crisis that a couple can endure. What it turned out to be is, I said, you know, I'm so glad to hear that. You know, we wrote back and forth. I'm so glad to hear that this was, you know, able to walk through some difficulty. And she said, yeah, in her final follow-up, said, this was not about anything outside of us, this was us ourselves.
Mm.
This was the couple itself had been in a very bad emotional place, and through taking the concepts of Powerful Peace, it was not about war, except in the most intimate way. It was about conflict, it was about not being on the same page, and it's about many things. We fight about many things. That's why we've said the catchphrase for the book is commonly relevant to the boardroom, the bedroom, and the battlefield. Yes, I'm a retired SEAL. Yes, I've been at war for 25 years. Yes, I've worked in 30-plus countries. And those are all essential elements of creating the Powerful Peace concept. The Powerful Peace message and mission is much, much bigger than any war journal. It's about human beings finding a wider perspective, being able to better understand and appreciate the perspective of another, and taking it to the next level. In this case, possibly saving a marriage, which, in my opinion, as the fundamental part of our society, the family is the core. I think that keeping families healthy is the same thing as the long-term keeping society healthy.
Right, right. Well, it's interesting because I'm reminded of our, I think, our last conversation, perhaps the conversation before, where we were talking about your paradigm shifts, the incidents that occurred in your life that kind of opened you up and allowed you to see the world slightly differently, more expansively. And it sounds like you now are having that kind of effect through your written word on other people. And it's great to hear that's happening not just in the boardroom and the educational institutions and possibly in the military establishment, but, as you said, in the bedroom. Very important.
And you mentioned a couple of other aspects that we should go into. The military establishment itself is comprised of many components. We typically imagine the military and we see a soldier standing in boots and camouflage uniform with a gun prepared to go do some war somewhere. But what the military really is a whole bunch of American and Canadian and British and Somali and Japanese and all every nation on earth that has its military force has its human beings composing that military. And they're putting on that uniform. It doesn't change the basic nature of being a human being. Another main element of military experience is, of course, our post-military career with the veterans, the people who, in many cases, have been at war, as I keep talking about. And the subtitle of the book is A Navy SEAL's Lessons on Peace from a Lifetime at War. And, of course, the message there is that I've seen so much conflict in so many aspects. I've seen interpersonal fights. I've seen people killing each other at the personal level. I've seen people killing each other at the international level because that was what they're directed to do. And once again, I'll caveat, this is not a peace-nick book. This is not a pacifist or a non-violent book. This is a book about practical peacemaking. And sometimes the only appropriate course is force. Sometimes with a suicide vest-wearing bomber walking up to me at my gate, the only appropriate response is a bullet in his face to protect my life and the lives of the kids I'm giving candy to. But when we look at the whole human being, and of course, you know, Michael, you've read the book, you know that it's divided into the four parts, body, mind, heart, and soul. Those are the four sections of the book. I could have used section one, section two, section three, but it wouldn't have gotten the message across. The idea we're talking about here in balance of whole person healing is that we are composed of various aspects inside of our own lives. I'm not just meat walking around with animal instincts. I have a heart, I have a soul, I have a mind, and if those aren't appreciated, those other aspects, if somebody's simply just too macho, he's just based on ego and muscle and stomps around, his life, although he may think he's got a pretty good thing going because he can think what he wants from most people, will inevitably end up bad. Because he hasn't got this simple compassion and understanding of other people's needs to realize that at some point somebody is bigger and stronger than you. And if for that one guy in the world who really is the biggest and strongest dude on the planet, there are still groups of people who are stronger than he is. So the veterans I was talking about, the people who have left the military, especially the combat traumatized PTSD, like many of my friends, I don't have PTSD and I'm not claiming to be a patient of a system. I'm just acknowledging what many of my friends in that community, in that subset of veterans, have talked about. So this is therapy. You read this thing. And the first pages of the book have the one-page letter to veterans and recruits. I put that deliberately before the chapters. It wasn't part of the introduction. It wasn't part of the preface or any of the table of contents. It was a single letter that speaks to veterans who have been scarred on their body, mind, heart, and soul, and recruits who will be scarred as a result of our duty. It's inevitable. We all experience some kind of changing that goes on and changes us from what we were to being the more effective fighting machine. But not only is it, I'll tell you a little secret here. There's a lot of little secrets. I guess in computer programming you talk about Easter eggs hidden throughout the programming. The letter to veterans and recruits is only partially addressed to veterans and recruits. On a larger scale, it's addressed to every reader who has never really taken 5 minutes to stop and think about the experience of being changed radically to serve one's country with force of arms. It's not a normal human experience. Maybe we have some thugs or boys who grew up fighting in high school and they think they understand what violence is, but that is nothing. That's baby steps on the road to war and war making. And so we need to appreciate those who have made the sacrifice, who have chosen that course, and who are on that path, so that we as a whole society, American veterans and non-military alike, can make a more healthy fabric. So so we can understand where each is coming from. I know, as in my GI years when I was in uniform, I actually did, contempt civilians, and I would say, along with my buddies, oh, those damn civilians, they don't understand. But the reality is we didn't understand their situation, and they couldn't understand our situation. And if we want to have a healthy nation, if we want to have a healthy world, if I want to have a healthy household, I need to understand better as much as I can.
You know, I want to go back to the first part of your comments. You're talking about kind of a whole person approach, and it's clearly laid out in your book in terms of each of the sections. And it seems to me that in many fields in human endeavors in the past 10, 15 years, there is an increasing and growing realization and acceptance of the whole person. Do you see this in many of the areas in which you've acted and been part of? Because personally, I see it like in medicine, there's the integrated or integral medicine movement. In education, you have some of the education movements which recognizes the whole person and people aren't just their IQs, as an example. Are you seeing this kind of whole person paradigm other areas too?
Absolutely. Within the military itself, we have great examples. Stan McChrystal and Mike Flynn, who wrote Fixing Intel, from his experience on as the intelligence boss for the coalition in Afghanistan. Other notable, Petraeus, Dave Petraeus and others, have been speaking to the needs of the population among whom we're fighting for a long time. They've struggled to get the message out there because it's not a popular message. It's not, it doesn't fit the war movie idea of us and them, which is one of the most destructive mindsets we can take, but it's second nature. We as humans have a default us and them perspective, and it's fair and natural that we should, because, again, it refers back. We've talked about this in previous interviews and other speeches and interviews I've given and in the book throughout. The us and them mentality is a very useful tool for self-preservation in situations in which there's a real threat. The problem comes from us applying the us versus them mentality to situations in which there is not a present threat. It actually limits our opportunity to work with others. If I have a problem with folks of another race, and I rejected working with them, or as I actually actively heard in the military. When I was a young sailor, I heard, integration of women was becoming more common, and more and more women were moving into more leadership roles, and I had bosses of mine, male bosses, who said, I don't care what happens or who it is, if I get a woman put in place of command over me, I'm resigning, leaving the military. Pretty radical expression of rejection for the, you know, the quality or ability of a woman to lead that individual. They were stuck in a mindset, as a lot of us have been for a long time, and there's many more to be broken. I'll put it that way. I'm not going to go into any hot topics today,
because there
are plenty more for us to dive down, and it'll take years and decades to work through them. But as I said in the front of the book, in the mid-90s when I went, or sorry, the mid-80s when I went to my first duty station, we male service members, a bunch of young idiots, would hang out at the base club on the weekends and watch the female service members, our peers, have striptease contests to the buff. And we would yell and cheer and hoot because, you know, hey, what young man doesn't like to see young ladies undressed? But the glaring hypocrisy was that on Monday morning we would arrive at our workplace and we'd all be wearing the same uniform and we'd all be subject to the same expectations of ethical behavior. And those expectations took the form of equal opportunity, sexual harassment, and other concepts that were on paper somewhere but had no relevance in our actual lifestyle. Because Saturday night, sexual harassment was required, if you will. It was part of what was expected of guys to howl at women and to leer at them. And on Monday morning, we had this schism between the 2 days earlier event and our expectations by our masters in the government. So,
mentioned a little bit ago, you gave the example of the perhaps young man, very masculine, macho, and who's really kind of underdeveloped, you might say. And it strikes me that one of the things that we're doing at the SEAL Fit Academy, the Unbeatable Mind program, is creating a new vision of the warrior. And the warrior is not just someone like a soldier who goes to war, but there's a kind of a warrior mentality, an integrated person who can take that ideal and way of being in the world and apply in all areas of their life, whether it's their personal life, in the boardroom, as you say, the boardroom, the bedroom, or in some cases, for those who serve, the battlefield. Talk to us a little bit about your ideas around a warrior, or perhaps a new warrior mentality and ethos.
I would love to, and I would really love to. Let's dive into that. There are, interesting that you would use the term of the new warrior ethos, because as far back as Sun Tzu, the idea of a warrior had a sense of balance and good judgment, discernment, patience, the ability to restrain one's urges to be forceful, to use force to solve a problem. For millennia, the warrior archetype has not been a raging, brutal beast. It's been a fellow, if you will, and I say fellow deliberately, because typically the warrior archetype has the male gender. But it's a male who has the incredible capacity to destroy. The greatest warrior has the greatest capacity to destroy, but the paradox is that he can't maintain that capacity to destroy unless he has the other qualities I mentioned, which includes judgment and patience. And in many cases, gentleness. I use examples from my own jiu-jitsu years in the dojo, and the fact that a jiu-jitsuka or a practitioner of jiu-jitsu cannot succeed in the dojo unless he has tremendous sensitivity. This is an advantage in terms of gender issues. Many of my female jiu-jitsuka partners in the dojo have had an initial advantage over me as I was going through the years and growing toward my black belt, and then in the recent years, because they had a sensitivity that they had embraced. They were willing to be sensitive. They were willing to feel, to sense, to be aware of what was going to happen in the fight, where a lot of us, the males in the room, have that young buck's macho, the bravado, and it works great if you're talking about beating up another boy on the high school playground. But if you're talking about facing very serious threats, real threats, sensitivity and awareness are extremely important. So while it does feel like a new warrior ethos to us today, there are people like Richard Strizey Heckler, who wrote, he's an Aikido practitioner and has written some fantastic books. I can't wait to meet him. I'll put it that way. In fact, I'll reach out and touch him soon. But Richard has written about that warrior ethos. Of course, the founder of Aikido, Ueshiba, he wrote about sensitivity and demonstrates awareness of one's surroundings, awareness of the need, the emotions, the situation another person is in. Aikido writer, I'll think of his name in a moment, but he's a white American man who went to Japan. Dobson, I think, and he went to Japan and studied under some real masters, and was on a train or a bus one time in Japan when a really bad dude came on board, a massive Japanese, drunk, so he could barely see straight, raging, and bowling through the car they were in like a bull, screaming at people, which you just don't do. Not considered appropriate to scream obscenities at old American people, much less Japanese people if you're young Japanese. But he was acting in that monstrous way by local mores, and he threw an old couple out of their seat and took the seat for himself and sat down and Terry Dobson. Terry's teacher, who weighed about a buck 05 soaking wet, an ancient Japanese man, Dobson was angry and eager to jump up and deal with this guy because he was almost as big as Dobson, who was a very big, like I said, a white American dude. He was filled with his own pride and his own ability to use his skills. He developed some fantastic technological skills at hurting people, at breaking people, and stopping behavior that we want to use force to stop. And we're all compelled. We all feel that tension, that desire to race in, be the white knight on the horse, and fix the problem where the evil villain is doing his thing. But if Dawson was going to try and approach this guy and fix the problem in his own force-based way, his teacher said, no, wait here. He went to the old, to the brute, and he sat down next to him. So you picture a guy, I don't know how much he weighed, maybe 200 pounds of angry drunk, and obviously very violent. And this little old man who weighed half his size sat down next to him and started chatting about the day. What happened? I'd love talking about these things, my wife, my kids, my family. And the man admitted in this, while he was engaged in this conversation, that his wife had left him because she was ashamed of him because he had lost his job. So he had gone out and gotten majorly boozed up and ready to kill. But what was all that rage and anger and violence was based on pain. So the way Dobson describes that scenario, as he watched it from a few seats away, this was a real paradigm shift, an incredible paradigm shift. He watched this little frail old man eventually, within a couple of minutes, having broken through the hard shell of this man's resistance to being a decent human being with other people around him, now this big brute ended up with his head cradled in the old man's hand, crying like a baby, because what he had experienced was the relief of not experiencing further resistance. If Dobson had gotten his face, somebody would have got broken up. There's no question about that. Probably both guys. There would have been some teeth and some blood in the car. In the end, though, the man got what he needed because the true warrior saw more than the young soldier next to him could perceive. So that's a long-winded way of saying that the warrior has always had sensitivity. The warrior has always had awareness. And what is our greatest archetype? It's not the warrior. It's the poet warrior. It's the scholar athlete. It's the person who has a healthy emotional and mental balance, the spirit tuned in, as well as being very, very highly trained and being an artist of destruction, which we are. In my community, we are artists of destruction. We can kill or break people in the SEAL teams and in the dojo, because that's our obligation, to be prepared to do that. But having prepared ourselves to do that, first of all, we find we'll have to do it less often, because there's a certain sense of danger that basically bad guys don't pick people who are prepared to deal with them. Bad guys pick weaker people. But the truly powerful person, the truly powerful warrior, has a fully developed heart to match the biceps, to match the spirit, to match the open mind.
You know, we've been talking about a more holistic approach, whole person, whole system, moving beyond your limitations of your thinking and stuff. And it strikes me that with your story of the Aikido practitioner, the old gentleman, that I think at this time in our history as a species, we might be kind of integrating the best of Eastern Enlightenment and the Western Enlightenment. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I agree with it, and I'm so glad that that's the case. Some people might look, we all have different perspectives. We have, for example, to use this, what might seem a silly example to a lot of folks, the astrological perspective. In the thousands of years of tracking the stars and watching, the wise men of the Bible were basically astrologers tracking the stars and reading omens. There's a song a few decades ago called The Age of Aquarius. And I'm not saying this is the Age of Aquarius. I'm not even thinking it is. I don't have a clue what that deeply means, because I'm not an astrologer, but there is a synergy. I am definitely, as I like to believe, an effective warrior, and my sensitivity for years has been perceiving that there is something in the air in a very big scale. Something is happening. There is something good coming. And as I wrote about just today, again, folks go to powerfulpeace.net and you go look at the blog there through the book site. I wrote just today that if we don't do something, if we don't take action now to open minds, if we don't perceive the trends of technological development that are not matched by the moral and conscious guidance of human nature, if instead we let technological advances proceed, then 19 men murdering 3,000 people in 2 hours as happened in 2001, potentially can be expanded exponentially.
Right.
And that gives me chills. And I know from being a practitioner of war and a practitioner of diplomacy with boots on the ground over these decades, I know that there's a way to get through to most people. And the way that begins, I've talked about Stephen Covey again and again, rest his soul. Again, he passed away a couple of weeks ago. It's a big loss, I think, for America and those who appreciated his teaching like I did. There is one of his steps in the Seven Habits of Highly Effective People is to seek first to understand, then to be understood. And if we take that stance, which is very uncommon and quite uncomfortable for many people, then we realize that what we're dealing with, a conflict or a problem we're facing, is oftentimes based on misunderstanding. Oftentimes. Not every time, but often. And when I'm in a conflict that's spiraling upward, that's starting to rise in intensity, and it's going to escalate, and I may be coming to blows soon, and no matter how good of a fighter I am, and many of my peers are aware that somebody could be a better fighter or have a better day. Just being a good fighter does not mean you should go take fights, unless you're doing it for a living, a competitive fighter who takes a fight one fight at a time. Just, in fact, we talk about brown belt syndrome being those fellows who earn their brown belt. They can't wait to be a black. They're so excited because they know they're just this close to being a so-called master. Of course, mastery is much farther past the belt. But they'll run out and start picking fights because they want to prove what excellent Aikido ka or Judo ka or Jujutsu ka they are. And they're looking for a fight. And they get it. People who look for fights find them. In my opinion, we do find what we're looking for. If it's peace of mind, I found that I can discover peace of mind. I can find it. If it's a fight, I guarantee you're going to find a fight if you go out there looking for it. So the brown belt runs around looking for fights because he feels he has something to prove. But in fact, when he really matures and becomes the true warrior, he doesn't look for a fight. He tries to avoid them because he understands the consequences are unpredictable.
I'm reminded of one of my favorite scenes in Enter the Dragon, which happens to be one of my favorite movies. I grew up watching it almost daily as a kid, a Bruce Lee movie. When he's asked what his art is, he says, it's the art of fighting without fighting. Remember the
like
scene?
That.
Seen the movie?
Yes, many years ago.
Yeah,
and
that is the
prevention is the point of powerful peace.
Yeah.
If I want to prove myself to somebody, if I want to prove that I'm bigger and badder than this guy in the bar, then I have a fight that I haven't touched on yet. That fight has nothing to do with the big stranger at the bar and everything to do with me.
Right.
I'm living a state of brown belt syndrome. And I don't prefer, Rob Dubois, I don't prefer to live that way anymore. Note that caveat. In other words, I've proven it to myself that that is not a tenable situation. To be running around looking for a fight, trying to prove I'm the baddest dude in any situation, it takes a toll. And it doesn't really yield many rewards because when I'm hostile, when I'm full of hostility or trying to prove my dominance over others, I meet resistance, which immediately begins to wear away at the value of my energy, what I'm spending. If I'm spending my energy to work with other people to make a really good thing happen, because there's plenty of needs out there, many, many needs in the world. We have kids suffering around the world. We have the opportunity to build schools or even civic centers, places to work with folks, to donate your time to a shut-in who's going to die in 3 years without having seen one visitor in her house 3 years from now. That's a shuddering situation for anybody with a heart. Imagine that, but it happens all the time. She has enough food, maybe the nurse or some traveling food people brings her daily meal, and that's it. Her engagement is it's almost like the failure to thrive of an infant who is not cuddled and loved, as we saw a lot happen in Eastern Bloc countries where children were warehoused after birth. Orphans were just tucked in cribs in warehouses of babies, and many of them died. Not because they're neglected on food or water or milk. They die because they're neglected on love.
Yeah, there's actually some really interesting research that's coming out these days, especially on oxytocin, which is a hormone produced, human beings produce it. it's increased in production when women give birth, but all human beings have it, men or women. It actually increases when you hug someone or you touch someone, and it's the hormone related to bonding. And I would imagine that if you're not being touched, you're not being hugged, you're not connecting with another human being, it lowers in your system. And from my understanding, there's a nice connection between it and the immune function. So you're talking about people who are at a disadvantage immunologically from not having human contact.
Exactly. And, okay, first of all, when was the last time you heard an interview with a Navy SEAL talking about hug therapy? I think that would be probably, we're going down a track that a lot of folks wouldn't expect, but that's what Powerful Beast is. People don't expect to see strippers at the base club when they first open the book and start reading the preface and the instructions. But that's what I put in there. I want to get people's attention. People don't expect to hear my story about watching 9/11 happen live, being hosted by Arab SEALs at their base in the Middle East, where I was teaching them how to fight terrorists, and then we all, 20 of us, watched almost 20 guys murder 3,000 people. And we did it side by side, 10 Arabs, 10 Americans. And we had a bonding experience that will never be matched. It was surreal, of course, because we all knew what the probable situation was on the planes, but we were helped to do anything about it. So that was, the book opens with that very real illustration of hate and immediately goes into harm, because I want people to get upset, and then I want them to feel the pain of seeing little bloody girls on examination tables, which are the consequences of conflict without being managed. And the loss that comes in chapter 3, where we talk about the soldier I attended in moral service. We went over this on a previous interview. And the losses are not limited to having one hero buried and one family losing its dad. The losses are replicated thousands of times a day around this planet. Losses like that, losses of loved ones, the suffering that happens through conflict situations, the unimaginable amputation of hundreds of thousands, amputations and machete deaths in Africa. It's as I actually quoted Stalin in the book. Stalin's quote that one death is a tragedy and a million is a statistic. Because right. I'm trying to refocus society on the reality that there's no such thing as a statistic. In isolation of the experience, of the human beings, the tragedy that's happening, and that there's something we can do about it. There's something we can act on in any situation. I mentioned the shut-in. I mentioned the Civic Center helping bring up kids. And again, the postings I did yesterday and today at the blog, again, through powerfulpeace.net, was about a teacher taking the lessons of Powerful Peace and incorporating it into a full curriculum for her school, for her high school class for 2013, teaching them the concepts of Powerful Peace, because this will make them not better Americans, although there's plenty of, my pride in my country cannot be muted. Of course I'm proud of my country, and at the same time I think with any true love relationship, you know, I have my eyes wide open about our flaws and where we can make changes and where we can do things differently. But this book is about making people healthier in their minds, their bodies, their hearts. It's about opening the aperture, about widening the mindset, so that we can be a better Republican or Democrat if that's what we happen to be. But do it with a sense of intent to make progress. Because our political scene today, and I've spoken with very experienced congressmen about this, I won't say any names here for their privacy, but very experienced, very well-known congressmen have said, you know, Robert, it used to be that we'd fight all day in the hall across the aisle, we'd call each other names and make great statements about how wrong the other side was, but we'd still go out and get a beer in the evening, and that doesn't happen anymore. And that is a dangerous, scary loss for this country, when we've been so polarized that political discussion, debate of any kind, can be reduced to calling the other side idiots. There's no progress, and that terrifies me. I'd rather have 50 cuffs, because we at least figure out who, you know, which side gains consensus and which side has the dominant opinion in the end, if it came to fisticuffs. But when we don't fight but simply abuse, we are not working for the best interests of the nation. And the economy, healthcare, sex and marriage, gun control, none of that stuff matters when we don't have a process in place that can actually make a difference in the country's preference in the right direction.
Yeah, I like to say our political system is structured to benefit only fundraising. So it's really easy to raise funds off the comments of the other side, or to make calling names of the other side. You know, it's really, it's divided that way. And you can fundraise off of it, and you can have uninteresting debates on these talking head shows. But as you're suggesting, you really can't solve any of the major challenges that are facing our country, which is a shame.
What you're describing is basically a new defense industry where, you know, and I've been part of it, I understand the criticism against an industry in which there's a huge profit margin for making machines and processes of war. So where's the incentive to work against the war? There's no profit margin in it. The same thing is true now in the political system. As you said, the fundraising and the fundraisers are benefited. They're enriched. Those who can twist the minds can twist the emotions far enough to hate whatever they is, the other side, them. When I can watch one news channel and despise another group of half of America, I'm wrong. And I can do that on several news channels right now. If I only watch that one news channel and I only listen to my own choir, then all I get is a harder, smaller, meaner mind.
Right. Right. Well, we might have to save the conversation about news and going more deeply into that for another day. I've been talking to Robert Dubois. He is the author of a powerful piece, A Navy SEAL's Lessons on Peace from a Lifetime at War. One of the themes, Rob, I've gotten from your book is prepare for war and practice peace. It seems to me that you are integrating the best of what's possible for us as human beings, religiously, spiritually, physically, mentally, emotionally, and laying out what's possible. And I think what's possible allows us to have hope and hopefully can move us in that direction of fulfilling some of the things that you're working so hard on bringing it to life. I appreciate you being on the show. I've enjoyed the last four conversations that we've had. This is our fourth. And we might have some surprise news for our listening audience and other listening audiences in the future. But for now, I just want to thank you for this conversation and our others. And I look forward to seeing your work spread around the globe.
You're very welcome, Michael. And you're also very welcome in advance for any surprises that may be sprung on the general populace in the near future. I can't wait to
talk
about
it. Good talking to you, Rob. Take care.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.